This is Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Maintaining bone strength is complex with no single solution. My patients who want to optimize their bone health have seen remarkable results with LiveMD as part of a comprehensive bone program. LiveMD is a Class 1 medical device cleared by the FDA. It creates a gentle, low-intensity vibration to benefit your musculoskeletal system. It's a safe, scientifically proven, and simple approach to maintaining musculoskeletal health and wellness. It really works, just 10 minutes per day. Go to livemd.us, that's livemd.us, to learn more about how LiveMD may improve your health. That's livemd.us. Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and once again, it is time for our weekly Q&A with Layla. Layla Mutin is our Hoffman Center nutritionist. She is a registered dietitian. She also holds a master's degree in the field of nutrition, and each week we answer your questions. You can send your questions to radioprogram@aol.com, and happy Thanksgiving, Layla.
Happy Thanksgiving, Dr. Hoffman. Wow. So, I can't believe it's holiday season.
Again. I know. It's amazing. The Christmas tree is up in Rockefeller Center, and the lights are up, and, starting to look a whole lot like Christmas here in New York City.
Yeah.
And, the temperatures to match. It's a little frosty, so we're starting to get the holiday feel. So,
I can't believe it's just a month away, Oh,
so
my goodness.
Are you preparing your tofu turkey for Thanksgiving?
No, tofu? I don't do tofu.
Okay. So you're not that kind of nutritionist.
No.
Oh, I got you confused.
It'll be a real organic bird. It'll be a real organic turkey.
I got you confused with the macrobiotic organic nutritionist. You're not that one.
No, yeah.
Okay.
Macrobiotics. Didn't you dabble in that at one time?
Not only dabble. I spent, I was a vegan for 17 years. From about the time that, shortly after I graduated from college, until roughly into the beginning of my medical career in the 80s. I was, at the same time that Dr. Robert Atkins across town was advocating the high protein, high fat diet, I was advocating a low fat vegan diet. I have certainly recanted my views on that. Ultimately, I think we do want a plant based component in our diet. Major contribution from fresh fruits and vegetables. For some patients, fruits are a little problematic because of sugar. But we've moved more towards, and I think it probably was around 1987 that I first developed the salad and salmon diet, which is, it really is akin to what is now termed the Mediterranean diet. And it does have carbs. It has complex carbs. But, as you know, there's no one diet
we
that fits
some.
All.
We need some. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, look, there's some cases where we do apply the ketogenic diet. There are certain cases, patients who have intractable seizures. There's some evidence on cancer on that. I recently returned from ACAM. I was in Las Vegas a couple of weeks ago at the ACAM conference, the American College for Advancement in Medicine, and a very fascinating lecture from Dr. Thomas Seyfried, who is exploring the use of a ketogenic diet. That's an ultra-low-carb diet, maybe just less than 15 grams of carbohydrates per day, put patients into ketosis, which he believes, and he's shown some evidence, that this can literally starve cancer cells and inhibit their growth. And he actually shared with us some cases of patients with very, very dangerous, invariably fatal brain cancer with prolonged 5-year survivals. So that's very profound.
It's very, very exciting.
Yeah.
Because cancer is the plague of our time. Yeah.
And you can't achieve that with rice and beans. It's not going to happen.
No, unfortunately. I mean, it's a more affordable diet, rice and beans, as opposed to grass-fed ribeye.
Exactly.
But, yeah.
So anyway, so in terms of revelations at the ACAM conference, there were many. Usually when I come back, the staff really dreads it when I come back because I have all kinds of ideas and new tests, new supplements, new procedures. But it's very creative because, each year we get recharged after we come back from conferences and learn new things.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So, I shared some of those in a podcast that I did that should be posted at drhoffman.com for our listeners last week. So, hopefully, some of our listeners can gain some insights from my experience at ACAM and some of the health practitioners out there who've not yet attended an ACAM conference. 2016, September, it's an opportunity to learn a whole lot more about natural medicine, get some really good innovative approaches.
Yeah. Wonderful conference.
Right.
Wow.
And I taught the IV section, which was well received. And of course, we now know that IVs, once considered an eccentricity, we're seeing great research on chelation therapy. The TACT study showed dramatic improvements in patients who'd had heart attacks with chelation. And what's interesting is when the data was analyzed, the results are far more impressive for chelation therapy than for statins, which are the mainstay of cardiovascular prevention.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. And there's little to no risk with chelation therapy, right? Like with a statin.
Well, I would say this. I would say that you have to be well-trained. That's why it's important that doctors administering a chelation course be properly trained because, you have to get the right dose. You have to select the patients correctly. There are potential issues that come up, and you have to learn how to cope with them. But I've administered many hundreds, perhaps over 1,000 chelations in my professional career, and no problems. No problems have been seen.
Yeah. Wonderful.
So, the good news is that a second study is underway now at the university at Mount Sinai Medical Center in Miami to hone in on the benefits of chelation for especially diabetic patients. Diabetic patients are at very high risk for cardiovascular disease, and it appears that they may be the ones who are the greatest beneficiaries of chelation therapy. So,
yeah.
That's exciting.
Again, I need to reiterate this, and it's something I've heard Dr. Atkins say, is that type 2 diabetes is almost a form of coronary artery disease because they progress like 60 to 70% faster.
Yes.
So it's, it's very exciting about chelation.
And even with metabolic syndrome, which is so prevalent in this country, that's the major, that rather than cholesterol, is the major driver of cardiovascular risk. If we could just nail that down. And I have to say, you're in the forefront of our battle against that because with your dietary counseling, you help patients avert progressive rises in their hemoglobin A1C and progressive weight gain and all the cardiovascular issues that are entailed in that.
Yeah. It's very exciting, very gratifying.
All right. And so more details on that conference in a separate podcast that I did while the memories of that conference were fresh. I wanted to share some of the clinical pearls from ACAM with our listeners. All right. So let's get to questions. Once again, our questions, you can send them to radioprogram@AOL.com. And let's start with today's questions.
Yeah, we've got an email from Karen about hypertension and hypokalemia. Hello, Dr. Hoffman and Layla. My husband, Andrew, has hypertension for 10 years. He's been on 2 medications since its onset. An endocrinologist recently questioned if it was Kahn syndrome because his potassium has been chronically low. What do you think? Is there something that could be done nutritionally for this? He's 52 and a lifelong vegetarian, sometimes a pizza eating one, but sometimes much better eating lots of vegetables and so forth. Also, he's been a long-haul pilot for 25 years, so his sleep has been messed up.
Yeah, that's actually an interesting detail there because circadian rhythm disturbances really can send blood pressure up, and they can occur because of shift work. And they can also occur because of sleep apnea. So when we do a physical exam, we very carefully look at the circumference of a patient's neck. If a patient has a really big neck, maybe they've got a crowded airway, and maybe they you know, and you don't ask the patient, you know, you ask the patient's partner about that.
Yes.
You know, do you observe your spouse or your partner snoring, and especially deep sonorous snoring with pauses in breathing that are associated with sleep apnea? That's a deoxygenation syndrome, which interrupts sleep and causes patients to spike their blood pressure. But also just shift work is murder on blood pressure. Mm-hmm. It really is problematic. As the Kahn syndrome, you know, I got to go way back to when I studied renal physiology in medical school. The guy who wrote the textbook was named Kahn, okay, C-O-N-N. And not to be confused with an ex-con, you know, different con. And so this, I have to say that renal physiology is one of the most challenging things in medicine. It really requires, you know, brilliant doctors to figure out, oh, you know, you have a potassium disturbance or an acid-base balance disturbance or sodium disturbance. There's so much that the kidney does to normalize levels of these electrolytes in your bloodstream. And Kahn syndrome is a disturbance of potassium metabolism. But, you know, it would seem to me that the key is to provide supplemental potassium. You can get that from vegetarian diets. You can get that from supplements. Your blood pressure, as you know,
potassium citrate,
Blood pressure, as you know, is a many-faceted thing. There's some patients who actually respond to calcium. There's some patients who respond beautifully to magnesium. I've really seen wonderful results sometimes with magnesium supplements. But other people don't respond to magnesium. It appears that there may be a racial component to this, that African-Americans have a gene which makes them more responsive to sodium. So they get the sodium out and they get the potassium up. In general, what you want to do is you want to reduce your sodium-potassium ratio. So, you know, reduce the sodium, increase the potassium. However, for certain patients, that may not have any impact at all on their blood pressure. So, you know, I would have to see this guy. You know, usually when we see a hypertensive patient, we ask a lot of questions. We say, well, is it sodium responsive? Is it potassium responsive? Is it magnesium responsive? Is it CoQ10 responsive? Is the patient insulin resistant? Is the patient suffering from sleep apnea? Is it a pure stress response? Because some patients have sky-high stress hormones, cortisol and catecholamines. And they
is
might...
Is the patient overweight?
Exactly. Or is the patient
sedentary? Yeah, we don't even know.
Is the patient sedentary? You know, do they have, could they respond to things that promote nitric oxide, like arginine or dietary nitrates? You know, these are among the considerations that, we may see. You know, hopefully there are many roads to Rome in terms of optimizing blood pressure.
Yeah. Karen, thank you for your question, and best of luck to your husband. Okay. We've got another question from Shari. A friend just bought a negative ion bracelet, so I started reading more about negative ions. How do you feel about the research? And if you think it's sound, would a bracelet be enough? And by the way, Shari says, P.S., I used to be a radio producer. Mazel tov on getting the radio program at AOL.com address. You probably had that for decades.
Right. That's a score, huh? Right? Because it's really easy to remember. You know, and it, domain names are so hard to nail down. Now people just kind of troll the internet, and they just buy up domain names in the hopes that somebody will come to them and say, hey, I'd like to buy that off you. And, you know, luckily we were able to get that on our own.
So I've been looking at a website called Science-Based Medicine. Contributors and editors are all MDs and scientists, and what they say is the bracelet claim is nonsense for two reasons. The first is that a piece of anything does not generate negative or positive ions, and that you can't change the net electrical charge spontaneously. You need a source of energy. So these devices actually that generate negative ions are powered in some way, such as a machine that you plug in or anything like that. And even if the bracelets did give off negative ions, I'm quoting from the site, there's no evidence of any healthy benefit from this.
Right.
You might build up a static charge and get shocked when you grab the doorknob. We have that to look forward to this season, right?
A little shock therapy.
But there's no evidence to suspect that negative ions will increase blood flow, as many companies claim.
I would stand by that statement. You know, but there actually is some evidence on negative ions and their impact on health. And I'm not saying that this bracelet generates that. I actually think this is in the realm of the real woo-woo, you know. Like, sometimes people have, like, these little devices that are like a little pendant, and they're supposed to fend off electromagnetic waves and create a sort of a safe space or force field around them so that all the impinging radio waves and EMFs don't affect them. And, you know,
What I'm visualizing right now is wearing aluminum foil hats.
Right. Or, you know, you could have a, you know, you could have like a Lucky Charm, you know, or like, you know, those little horns that people wear, or, you know, maybe, you know, like a little amulet. Those things with like the hand of Fatima, you know, to ward off the evil eye. I think it's a latter day version of that. It's wishful thinking. And hey, you know, if it gives you a placebo effect, hey, knock yourself out. But when it comes to negative,
placebo effect is strong.
Sure, it's real. It's real. I mean, if you think it's fending off all evil, great, good for you. But negative ions. There are some studies on negative ions. One of the phenomena that we see that in nature is that at the seashore, because of the crashing of the waves, there's a higher level of negative ions. And for me, you know, one of the most pleasant things is to walk along the ocean, you know, barefoot in the sand, and sort of inhale the clean air. And there's something about that that appears to be relaxing and may create a reset for the brain. So it's been studied, but it's hard to pin down. There are studies that actually look at treatment of seasonal affective disorder with light and negative ions. Negative ions seem to enhance the effects of light therapy for seasonal affective disorder. The one problem I found with true negative ion generators, you can get them, but what they do is they will they put an electric charge on particles in the air, and there's plenty of dirt in the air. And what that then happens is it will create sort of a halo or an aura of soot around the machine, such that you have to repaint the wall behind the machine. I've had that happen a few times when I had a negative ion generator against a white wall in my home. So it will tag particles electrostatically. They will then stick to a surface, which I guess is good because they're out of the air. You're not breathing them. But, you're going to have to get the paint can out. Especially here in New York. Because, man, it doesn't take long to get a sooty halo around the machine.
Right. That and having to wipe down the windowsills every 3 days or so. Yeah.
Oh, isn't it ridiculous? I mean, I just did a major cleaning on the apartment. It's so satisfying. Everything's, you know, spanking clean. And I like to leave the windows open, right? You get a little fresh air in.
Mm-hmm.
But you're letting all that crud in. And
that's true.
And pretty soon, you know, you swipe your finger on a surface on the, you know, on the wooden table or the floor. And oh, my goodness.
Yeah. People leave their windows closed for that reason.
Which is not good.
You could open the top window. But that lets the hot air out. Well, anyway. Or you could get a negative ion air purifier.
Just get a pure air purifier. You know, I think
just get an air purifier.
It'll suck some of the things out of the air. And
right.
I guess at one point what we should do is a little consumer report on what the best negative ion, not the the best air purifier would be for our listeners. You know, could do a little research on what the best overall unit, you know, from a price point and from efficacy might be. Because, you know, there's a lot of junk that we inhale. Inner air pollution is a big issue.
Absolutely. Yeah. Sherry, thank you for that question. Okay. We've got another question from Shesha. I hope I'm pronouncing your name correctly. I think this is coming possibly from from Southeast Asia. This email, let's see, sir, I wish to know.
You know what? This is a tip-off. Whenever somebody refers to us as sir, they're from a foreign country.
Yeah, I think
Cause,
so.
Because that level of respect, so, you don't hear that. Yeah. You know, it's like.
So Shesha writes, sir, I wish to know whether citrates are to be avoided by people with gout.
Mm-hmm.
Kind regards. I think citrates are helpful for people with gout. I'm looking at a recent study where they looked at trying allopurinol and trying potassium citrate, and potassium citrate was very beneficial, and even the combo preparation was even more significantly beneficial than that, because it can help with the hyperuricemia.
Right. And we know that the citrates are helpful for another type of stone phenomenon, which is calcium oxalate stones. You know, for magnesium citrate and potassium citrate are used for prevention of stones. So when it comes to gout, vitamin C appears to be helpful. Also, in terms of natural substances, tart cherry juice, right?
Tart cherry juice,
we've seen,
yes.
You know, that as being helpful. There's a type of nutraceutical, which is Devil's Claw.
Devil's Claw.
Yeah, which is not frequently used for arthritis, but it seems to be particularly helpful for gouty arthritis. And so while we're talking about gout, you know, you're the expert on gout diet. Tell us what you might recommend from a dietary standpoint.
Well, high levels of uric acid, number one, can be associated with insulin resistance.
Yes.
So that's something I would look at first, metabolic syndrome, insulin resistance. I'd also remove the more overt purines in the diet, at least in the beginning, organ meats, mackerel, sardines, red wine, things of that nature, maybe red meat, or at least to reduce the consumption of those particular foods.
And there's some surprises there, because I think there's some vegetarian foods that actually contribute to gout, if I'm not mistaken. It's it would be beans actually may have contribute to gout, although they're vegetarian. And there's a couple. Is it asparagus that's one that is a contributor to gout, if I'm not
that
mistaken?
That might be.
Yeah.
That rings a bell.
Okay.
I think so.
So actually, when we put people on a low-meat diet, because meat is thought to be the culprit, we can get in trouble, because sometimes people substitute a lot of refined carbohydrates. And the biggest culprit in terms of gout, or one of the big ones, is certainly fructose and high fructose corn syrup, right?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
That will directly raise uric acid levels. And that's also associated with insulin resistance as well.
Indeed.
Any sugar refined carbohydrate can contribute to the high blood sugar, high insulin, and then higher uric acid. So that's something that always needs to be looked at. You know, the purines are really a middleman, and not as helpful, in my experience. So it's,
yeah, I mean, just a total elimination of animal protein might be counterproductive. Now, there are a couple of types of animal protein that do not contain purines. Which are eggs
chicken.
And, well, chicken a little bit, but eggs have not zero.
Right.
And
you'd
dairy.
Want to probably avoid the dark meat poultry, yeah.
Right. And dairy. And dairy, right? Yeah. Because dairy is, I think, not contributing. And it's a source of protein which doesn't contain them. You see, I guess the way to think about it, here's the way to think about it, is what are purines? Purines are a product of DNA. And when you eat milk is actually a secretion which has no DNA in it. Eggs have a tiny speck of DNA. You know, when you see the little germ sometimes of the tiny chicken embryo, and you say, oh, okay, there's a little tiny chicken there in that egg. But it's actually nutrition for the embryo to grow on. Meat, of course, is flesh, and flesh are cells, mammalian cells or bird cells. They all have DNA. The DNA density is determined probably by the redness of the meat to some extent. And then there is DNA in pulses and grains, because they're actually they're seeds, or they promote they contain DNA coding for plants. So that's why you could get some purines from plant sources.
Mm-hmm.
So think DNA, reduce your DNA intake, the genetic material that delivers purines.
Yeah. Right. And certainly reduce any of your refined carbohydrates and sugars and all of that.
Which contain no purines, but still dry gout. I think, actually, I have to say that this is where maybe we have a little bit of a leg up on traditional nutrition. Because in traditional nutrition, it's just about avoidance of purines. And that's the way you were probably taught. But we now have the insight that even without any purines in the food, if you have just sugar, there's no purines in sugar, it will drive our own synthesis of uric acid. Your body makes it, and it, in response to substances that you know, do not contain purines.
Yeah. Thank you very much for your question, Shesha. Yes.
All right, so we're going to take a pause because this is our podcast is divided into two parts, and as usual, we're going to conclude part one, and we'll segue to part two. So, what are we going to talk about in part two?
Oh, can Ostanol help my bone graft in my upper jaw?
Oh, interesting. Okay. Mm. We'll tackle that question in just a moment. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, today with Hoffman Center nutritionist Leila Mudin, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.